Welcome to the Two Cities Podcast. I'm John Anthony Dunn, and today we're going to talk about social identity theory and our political discourse. And joining me to have this conversation is Dr. Chris Porter, who has a PhD from Ridley College in Melbourne and is currently a postdoc at Trinity College, Melbourne. How's it going, Chris?
Yeah, doing well. Early morning here, and it's lovely.
Well, it's snowing right now here in Minnesota.
I'm missing the cool weather at this time of year, I got to say.
Yeah. So obviously the reason why it's warmer for you is because you're in Australia. And speaking of being in Australia, curious to know what your thoughts are about the whole political situation for us here in the States. We're a few weeks out from Election Day. Some of us, like myself, have already voted, but it's going to be a wild couple of weeks. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's crazy. Just looking on, I mean, the whole voting system in America just and lead up to it, which runs for almost 2 years beforehand, is just insane. But yeah. I think I pay a reasonable amount of attention to the American election cycle because in November, every four years you have an election, and every November we're in the States for SBL normally.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, being the exception to that, of course. And so looking on, I think Australians often find American politics quite bizarre. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a two-party system effectively where only two parties are big enough to be able to hold any sort of power, right. Very few independents. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Australia, we still also have a two-majority party system, but we have a Greens party, which is which has a reasonable amount of power, and a whole bunch of minor parties and independents who get voted in on a fairly regular basis. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that Australians often find really weird about American politics is just the lack of bipartisan engagement. Mm-hmm. You're either red or you're blue. You're mm-hmm. a donkey or mm-hmm. you're an elephant. And for that matter, donkeys and elephants, what's the go there? I mean, I don't know many other places where you not anthropomorphize, you animalize mm-hmm. the political parties. This is just completely bizarre. And then how much people ascribe their identity, who they are mm-hmm. to their party. Mm-hmm. We get a little bit of that here between the Labor Party and the Liberal Party. For those listening on, our Liberal Party is on the right wing of the spectrum. You know, being in Australia, we have to have everything upside down and back to front. So our political spectrum is a little bit different, but we do get some of that sort of party politics here and party identification, but not to the same degree as you do in the States.
Yeah. So speaking of that lack of bipartisanship in America, of course, that is a more recent thing in terms of how bad it's gotten. It's gotten quite out of control. But you're talking about political identification. And so that's a good segue into kind of just having a bit of an overview of what is social identity theory itself. And we'll, begin to think about how this might be really helpful for us as we think about that political identification and then political discourse that stems from that identification.
Yeah, for sure. So social identity theory is a sociocognitive psychological approach to how groups operate and how groups interact, but also how people identify as part of the group that they're within. So it's not just about how the social aspects are, but the personal aspects or the individual aspects as they relate to the group. So it was initially defined or initially sort of set forth by a Polish Jew called Henri Tajfel. And his sort of impetus for it was in World War II, he was captured as part of the French army in the first German run across France and sent to the concentration camps, at which point he was mistaken in his identity. The German captors thought that he was a French Jew, not a Polish Jew. And so if he was a Polish Jew, he would have probably been sent to Treblinka, which is in one of the concentration camps in the east, where most of the Jewish population were gassed, including most of his family. But instead, he remained in the west of Europe, where far fewer were, and there was a policy of not sending the French Jews to the in the same degree to the chambers. And so he, at the end of the war, he ascribed his entire survival of his years in the concentration camps to being a mistaken identity, to being mistaken either as a Frenchman versus a Pole or as a non-Jew versus a Jew. There's a bit of consternation there as to which identity was mistaken. But he realized that there's a significant amount of who you are, who we are as people, which is tied up in the groups that we're part of. And so he went on to look at social identity theory, and he defined social identity as that part of the individual self-concept which derives from their knowledge of their membership of a social group, or groups for that matter, multiple groups, together with the value and emotional significance attached to that membership. So it's really about how people identify as people within a group, and also ascribe a value and emotional significance to that membership within the group. And we can see this at every element of society, whether that's the football teams we support,
right,
or for that matter, being a football versus a hockey supporter. I mean, baseball's just isn't wrapping up at the moment. I'm not a baseball follower, but
The World Series
wraps up about now.
The World Series is up next.
I'm pretty sure Chris Song is watching baseball instead of being on the podcast with us at the moment.
Yeah, especially because the Dodgers won Game 7 last night to make their way to the World Series.
So he's definitely going to be deep down that hole.
Yeah.
But being a follower of a certain sport, or for that matter, as more relevant to our conversation today, being a supporter of a political party isn't just about the cognitive, what I think about things or how do I understand things, but the value and emotional significance that comes from being part of that. So the way that this tends to work out for the majority of people, and the way that we can observe it happening, is through three kind of pithy functions, cognitive functions or processes that we go through. The first one is thinking about normative fit, which is thinking about how do I know that I'm part of a group? What are the normative things for this group? You know, I'm a cheesehead, so I'm a Packers fan. So one of the normative things for that is a love of Green Bay, a love of Aaron Rodgers, a distinct sense of displeasure about watching Tampa Bay on the weekend.
Right.
But then there's also the comparative fit. How do I know that those other people in another group aren't part of my group as well? And what are the things that set my group apart from that other group? So, that may be the politics that we have. That may be the locations that we have. That may be shibboleths, to use the biblical term, shibboleth, the accent or the dialect that we speak.
Yeah.
That may be how we engage with the world. Regularly when I'm in the States, I'm identified by my accent. I'm identified as an out-group member. I'm not an American because I'm an Australian. And so that is one of those interesting things with the comparative fit. And then the last one is categorization. So we want to be able to quickly assess whether people are part of our group or not part of our group. And so we categorize. And the way that we often do that is we create stereotypes. And a stereotype's not necessarily a negative thing. Stereotyping is just a process of being able to put things into categories. So for example, if you're walking along the road and you see an animal with four feet or four legs, fur, a tail coming towards you, it's probably a dog or a cat. But if you're in the bush in sub-Saharan Africa and you see an animal with four legs, a tail, and fur coming towards you, growling, it's probably a lion and you should run. And that's why we need to categorize well. And of course, sometimes categories, we struggle with categories that we don't necessarily have the category for things. So for example, a bird is usually categorized as something with feathers, wings, a beak, flies. So you see a seagull or you see a pigeon, you see a dove, they all fit into that category. But so we have a stereotypical bird image in our head. This is what a stereotypical bird looks like. What happens when you get a pigeon, when you get an ostrich, or what happens when you get a penguin? These aren't stereotypical birds, so we have to spend a lot more time categorizing them. On a more humorous side of things, my son learned that the category of dog has four legs, a tail, and is big, and it's scary. He also had the category of rat, which my wife is afraid of rodents. They're fairly small, have whiskers, a tail, furry, and low to the ground. Well, I was pushing him along in his pram one day, and a guy came walking towards us in the other direction with a chihuahua on a lead. And my son goes, rat, because it was closer to his stereotype of a rat than it was of a dog.
Oh, that's a great example. Well, so following up on this idea of stereotyping and compartmentalizing, categorizing, so where is the line? When is it a problem? And specifically, I think about like generalizations, right? So we can often generalize, and this is where things like, you know, our prejudicial sort of stereotyping like really comes in. So maybe for listeners who recognize that stereotyping is inevitable, categorization is inevitable, but there's also obvious problems that societally we have with stereotyping as well. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, for sure. I think the big struggle with stereotyping, and for that matter, group identification as a whole, comes with value and emotional significance. It's that side of the equation which really drives a lot of the negative aspects. So Tashfell was originally interested in why people estimate certain lines as longer than others, visual perception issues. Mm. And so one of the things he noticed was that people ascribed value to things that were close to. So if you had people estimating the size of cardboard discs, cardboard circles, mm-hmm. and they could generally estimate them as reasonably close to their actual size, but you had them estimate the size of coins, and coins that were worth more were often ascribed a greater size. They were perceptually overestimated than the size that they actually were. That's a value and emotional significance associated with the visual processing, visual stereotyping. Mm. And he noticed that we actually do this in group interaction as well. So one of the really early experiments in social identity theory was to look at what makes up a group, what's the minimum set of characteristics that make up a group. And so he assigned a whole bunch of people to either one of two groups, whether or not they liked the artist Paul Klee or Vasily Kandinsky better. So completely abstract conceptual groups. Do you like Klee or Kandinsky? Are you a Klee person or are you a Kandinsky person? What he didn't tell them was that they're actually completely randomly assigned. He didn't care whether or not they like Klee or Kandinsky. He just randomly assigned them to one of two groups. He then asked them to do a whole bunch of tests about assigning money to their group or members of the other group. And he has a forced choice. So you could assign $4 to your group and $3 to the other group, or you could assign $10 to your group and $10 to the other group and things like this. And you had to choose between a bunch of pairs of money assignments. What he found wasn't just that people favored their own in-group, that they assigned more money to their in-group, but they actively assigned more money to the in-group where the out-group got the least amount possible.
Oh, wow.
So they didn't just maximize in-group profit. They maximized inter-group differentiation.
Wow.
So they favored their own group at the expense of the other group, even if that meant that they didn't get as much money in the end.
Right. That is so fascinating. Wow.
Yeah. So that's one of those areas where that suddenly the stereotyping takes on a more sinister note, doesn't it?
Right.
People aren't just prioritizing their group, but they're prioritizing their group at the detriment of another group to maximize the differentiation between two groups. I think we see this all the time in sports. We'll just choose a neutral thing. Yeah. Are sports neutral these days? I don't know. we're not close to the Super Bowl yet, but I won't mention the World Series. But we see that in the football, where people barrack for teams that can set their team up in a better position on the ladder by making another team lose.
I'm definitely that kind of a sports fan. I root in the way that will most benefit my favorite teams. So like when other teams are playing each other, I think about playoff ramifications, these sorts of things. I totally, totally get that.
Yeah, so everyone wants to see the Patriots lose because their team will end up going up against Pats in the postseason. And so therefore they want to see the Pats as low down the ladder as they can. And I think you see this in all sorts of aspects. And it really highlights where we find our group value and our group identity really matters. Mm-hmm. Because it matters then what groups we're going to be diminishing, what groups mm-hmm. we're going to be literally discriminating against.
Right, right. And speaking of discrimination, I mean, one of the main ways that we do that is in our discourse and in the way that we talk to each other on Facebook. Because there's a lot of division right now in American politics, it just gets really bad, really heated. So our discourse is riddled with all sorts of stereotyping that is beyond just kind of the mere categorization of, okay, if you're more blue or if you're more red, you vote like this or that. It gets quite nasty. There's a villainification that yeah. takes place. Yeah. Could you maybe share a little bit about that process?
Yeah. And I think one of the aspects there is that social media has taken our in-group discourse and amplified it to the world. Mm. In the past, you'd said we'd have to pick up the phone, or before that, we'd have to write a letter to someone in order to be able to have discourse with them if they weren't physically with us. These days, we've taken that what is generally a private domain of discourse to people on a phone or a group phone call or a circular letter. But we've taken that, we've made it completely public and instant. So you can write on someone's wall, or you can send group chat messages, which can be screenshot and shared on, whatever social platform. And we see this quite regularly, people screenshotting others' private messages and sending them out to the world. Mm. But that makes this degree of discourse more focused around the normative and comparative fit metrics and how you categorize. Because suddenly there is there's no guarantee that there is normativity in your group, because others can be watching on, and so you have this discourse which is by its very nature focused on comparativity. So making sure that everyone knows that this group is out or that you're in this group. And that's amplified by especially Facebook, and I'm guessing most of the other social media metrics, where the way that we consume media influences the media that it shows to us. Mm-hmm. And so the more that we consume media which fits within what Facebook or whatever social media thinks our group paradigm is, the more we'll get to see that. And so we end up becoming siloed in our discourse, but not just siloed in our media discourse, so what is being fed to us. Mm-hmm. So in the past, in Australia, you might have been a subscriber to one news service or one newspaper, or your family might have always watched a certain TV news each night. And that's what's being fed to us. But now it's not just that it's being fed to us from externally, but it's being reinforced internally. So it's not just, it's people from within our group, within our tribe, who are saying the same things, and we're only seeing what they're saying. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the market square prior, you would have been able to hear what other people are saying. There's that theoretical level of discourse that happens at the city gate, to use the biblical metaphor of as people come to the city gate to be able to discuss things. Mm-hmm. These days, our media and our discourse is so siloed that we're only hearing in-group voices. Mm-hmm. Which makes it very easy and very powerful to denigrate out-group voices. And it becomes a very significant way of being able to do that. It comes back to that emotional significance. If the only people that you know are part of a certain, in this case, political in-group, then to leave that in-group or to question that in-group doesn't just call into question your beliefs or mm-hmm. your thoughts or your cognition, mm-hmm. but your values and your emotional significance. Mm-hmm. Who am I as a person if I'm not a Democrat? Or who am I if I'm not a Republican? Mm-hmm. Becomes the way that people start thinking about their tribes. Mm-hmm. People start identifying primarily as a adherent of their political party.
Right.
And you can extend this to religion, to the church, where denominations become more salient. You can extend it to all sorts of different aspects. Sadly, it often comes up in times of conflict. So we saw in the Rwandan genocide the very stark differentiation that came from the stereotyping and siloing of Hutus and Tutsis, which was mainly a external intervention on the tribe system from the Belgian colonializers, categorizing people into Hutus and Tutsis. And therefore the value and the emotional significance of being one of those two tribes led to all-out bloodshed and war and genocide. So we can see very easily where this falls down, I think.
So if the end result is intergroup conflict and violence, I mean, that's a horrible thing to think about. And in the States right now, there are groups who are, you know, essentially talking like, you know, if the other side wins, then, you know, all hell's going to break loose, right? There are people that are talking like that. And there are voices, you know, journalists who are talking about, like, you know, are we seeing the beginning of another civil war? These are horrifying thoughts, but they're rooted in this kind of social identity dynamic where the us them is so strong that the us of American is obliterated, basically. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, and I think we've even seen a little bit of it already with a couple of shootings and then people driving cars into protests. But then I guess as an example of how intergroup discourse goes wrong, the Proud Boys rally.
Exactly.
And then suddenly you had on Twitter whole bunches of same-sex attracted men posting gay photos, and I use the term gay because I use it, posting gay photos under the hashtag Proud Boys. Mm-hmm. And so this just serves to reinforce the discourse and reinforce the conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the struggle here is that it feels, in order to foster discourse and in order to foster intergroup conversation, which leads to conflict reduction, it can feel a lot like compromise. You're compromising on your beliefs. You're compromising on what's normative for your group. You're compromising on what's comparative, who the other is. Mm-hmm. And it can be incredibly difficult to do. And I think often it comes through external to use what Murray Bowen talks about in family systems theory, a triangulation metric. It comes through an external aspect, some third party part, which can be triangulated in so you can find common ground. So one of the areas I think this often happens is in music. I noted last week, or a couple of weeks ago, when we were talking about pacifism, the place of metal in that, and which brings people together, from both parts of the spectrum. And I'm reminded of the story of Daryl Davis, who's a American boogie woogie piano player, big African American man, who his hobby is to befriend members of the Ku Klux Klan and to extricate them from the Klan, including a couple of Grand Wizards and some others. And he has a documentary called Accidental Courtesy, which is amazing. But I think one of the areas there is that there's almost a neutral ground or a shared common interest, a shared social group. So we talked earlier that our political parties or our conflict groups aren't necessarily the only groups that we're part of. We may have plenty of other shared interests or shared groups that are fertile ground for intergroup on that level, but intragroup on a different level. For example, you and I both aficionados of craft beer.
Yep.
And there'll be many others who would probably disagree with on a whole bunch of issues, be they political, be they questions of religion, be they questions on the new perspective.
Yep.
All sorts of issues like that.
Yeah.
Who would be more than happy to sit down over a beer with and chat about all sorts of things, including those conflictual issues. Mm-hmm. And while it may seem like compromising on the conflict groups, it's not compromising on the shared craft beer loving group or the football supporting or whichever other category, whichever other group that they're part of that we share.
Right. Yeah. I'd like to chat a little bit more about the topic of compromise, because that's something that we have been discussing in our conversation on faith and politics and also the conversation on war and political theology is actually this topic of compromise. So we heard from Reverend Maeve Sherlock, that basically every important relationship that she's ever had, anything that's really important that she's ever been involved with has necessitated some level of compromise. And that was a really interesting insight for us to all hear. And last week, Michael Spaglione talked about compromise and talked about how he's kind of an all or nothing sort of person, and how there's not, for him, there's not much wiggle room with when it comes to compromise, because he brought up the example of the Donner Party and just cannibalism, and just thinking, you know, how do you sort of, you know, have a moderate approach with cannibalism, right? Like, oh, it's just one finger or something like that, right? And, you know, for him, like, kind of the idea of moderation in everything is a kind of excessive idea, right? Because you're not moderate in your moderation, which is an interesting, you know, thing to think about. And I love that those two episodes basically juxtapose kind of different perspectives on compromise. It's sort of like the two proverbs side by side, where it's like, you know, answer not a fool in his folly and answer a fool in his folly, right? There's just kind of a beautiful juxtaposition. But I'd like for us to think about this a little bit more, because what I gather is really what Maeve was getting at is this idea that, you know, you're not always going to get 100% of what you want, right? In terms of political, she's a politician, right? So that's kind of where she's coming from. You're not always going to get 100% of what you want. So you make the proposal that you think is like in the best interest of all your constituents, et cetera, and your neighbor and your people more broadly. But at the end of the day, when you're working with other politicians who have different purposes or whatever, you can't really have this kind of all or nothing attitude, that you need to be able to say like, okay, well, if I can't get 100% of what I feel like we all need, I want to aim for that 70%, right? So, or something like that, right? And I'm not trying to speak on her behalf, but this is just kind of how I was taking her perspective. Now, that's really hard for us in America right now. So many of us are just decidedly on one side of the aisle or another. I mean, they talk about these mythical creatures called undecided voters. I don't know that they really exist, but it's quite partisan, and it's so partisan that it's viewed as extreme compromise to have any nuanced thinking, right? You are either completely on board with everything that is a talking point on the right, or completely on board with everything that is a talking point on the left. And there's a lack of that kind of nuanced thinking, a lack of this ability to kind of be a part of that in-group, but also self-critically reflect upon maybe those aspects about the in-group that one isn't entirely on board with. What are your thoughts about navigating this issue of compromise relative to identity?
Yeah, and I think compromise there's a real struggle in thinking about how we identify as part of groups and how we engage in compromise, or whether or not that involves engaging in compromise. I find it interesting as an Anglican. Anglicans follow the middle way. We want the way that is between other things. So I'm not surprised that Maeve went down that line, both as a politician and as an Anglican. Uh-huh. But Michael Spaglione I found interesting, because in citing the Donner Party, effectively compromised on cannibalism. Mm. They compromised on, but they held strong to a non-compromising view on living. In order to hold a strong position on non-cannibalism, mm-hmm. You have to compromise on another group dynamic, which is the ability to be able to feed yourself, and who's going to die. Mm-hmm. And this is where I think sometimes we reduce, and I find this especially in political discourse, but we reduced certain intergroup discourse and we down to talking points, mm-hmm. but we make those groups the primary aspects. Mm-hmm. So in an election year, people aren't going to be have what's salient, what is at the forefront of their minds, as the other groups that they're part of. So people cease to be Californians or New Yorkers. They become Democrats. They cease to be Texans. They become Republicans. And that in itself becomes a compromise, because there are many things that the federal apparatus does which actually go against the best interests of your state. In the same way, there are many things that may be features of the party that you follow, which you have to give up or you have to compromise on other beliefs in order to be able to follow those tenets. And because we flatten things out to single groups, what is the group that's most salient? What's the group that's most important to us at any one time? I think often we make the compromise in a total form. We totalize the compromise. Whereas in any other form of discourse, in any other form of engagement, we're constantly juggling the various groups that we're part of. And so while it may be in order to hold true to a certain group, hold true to a certain ideology, hold true to a certain value and significance in a membership, and that's salient or that's important for a certain context, it's inevitably going to compromise another area. And so we happily juggle those compromises in almost any other area of life. Sometimes there are things that come up for us. There are contextual situations where we seem to say, no, we can't compromise on X, Y, or Z aspect. But it's not that we, in saying that we can't compromise on that aspect, it's not that we are then saying that we can't compromise on every aspect. But it is saying that the other aspects that we are compromising on are less important than the one aspect that we're not compromising on. This, I think, comes back to the discourse, where it comes back to discourse and says, because there's no other voices in the room, we don't see the compromise that we're making. We don't see how not compromising on X means compromise on Y.
Yeah, you know, thinking of some concrete examples, I think of like Mitt Romney being the only Republican to vote in favor of impeaching Donald Trump. On social media, I saw a number of people say like, oh, he's not really a Republican, or like he's outed himself as, you know, being, you know, a secret Democrat, or these sorts of things. And it's it's this inability to think about Republican identity outside of towing the line on everything, you know. And similarly, like right now with the whole Republicans for Biden dynamic, you know, as another kind of concrete example of a group that's saying this is our identity, and within that identity we are voting in a particular way that seems out of step with, you know, broader mainstream Republicanism. I should say mainstream as it has become in recent years. It's not out of step with, of course, historic Republicanism. It's the party as a whole is not where this group is at, obviously. Yeah. But maybe share a little bit about these concrete examples of people who essentially are planting a flag and saying that they are doing these sorts of things as Republicans from within a particular identity, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the big struggles in that, as we talked earlier, there's a normative fit. There are the things that are normative, the things that are that let you know that you're part of a group. But they tend to be the things that theoretically everyone shares in that group. So you may have tenets A, B, C, D, E, F of things that which people individually believe make them part of a group. So being pro-life or pro-choice, holding to certain economic outcomes. Are you an objectivist? Are you a realist? What's your position on big and small government? These are all aspects of what people find normative about a group. And they tend to be, to some degree, shared, but they're often assumed. And that if you're a Republican, you must be pro-life. If you're a Democrat, you must be pro-choice. They're assumed characteristics. And rather, a lot of our current discourse happens on the comparative fit level. So we're not talking about what makes us in. We're talking about what makes other people out. So when you get these Republicans for Biden, or you get Mitt Romney endorsing the impeachment, this is a comparative fit metric. They are different to us because we would not endorse Biden. We would not vote for impeachment. So therefore, even though they may share a broad range of normative characteristics with us, we see the comparative aspect and say that they are not part of our group.
Can you talk a little bit about how it's particularly difficult to speak critically or negatively about one's in-group and that dynamic of social identity. Because obviously Romney and these other Republicans who are quote unquote like never Trumpers, right, as they're sometimes called, this is not something that is perceived by the broader Republican Party. It's not part of the normative fit, like we all are on board with Trump or that this sort of thing. Why is it particularly tricky to say anything critical or negative about one's in-group?
Yeah, and I think this is one of the struggles that we have in our modern era. One of the things with leadership is that leaders are expected to champion the activities of the group. Mm. They're expected to be not just in-group members, but prototypical in-group members, ones that embody all of the characteristics and do so visibly and do so in such a way that espouses the very nature of the group. So Alex Haslam and Steve Riker and Michael Platow have a really good book called The New Psychology of Leadership, which goes into this as leaders are champions for their group, not just the great men of history, but they're really group champions. Mm. And so therefore criticizing your own group shows you to be a deviant from that group as well. Mm. And this is one of the paradoxes that we have with leadership. In order to get a group to do something, even if that is in line with the aims and aspirations of that group, you still have to be deviant from the position that you have. You have to input power into the group. I mean, Newton's laws say that a body at rest will continue to stay at rest until it is given a push. Mm-hmm. In terms of social dynamics, that push comes from a leader or from a groundswell of the group. But some form of power being exerted upon the group in order to make it change. Mm. When that comes from within, when that comes from the inside, it means that there is a difference from an intrinsic difference between that leader, say Mitt Romney in this case, and the rest of the group. That means that there is a point of comparison. There's a point of comparative fit, which is not normative. Mm. And that's what makes it so hard, because it runs every time you want to change your group or you want a group to move, mm-hmm. you run the risk of splintering the group into subgroups. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you don't have one group, you have two groups. Mm. You have Republicans for Trump and you have Republicans for Biden.
Right.
At that point, it ceases to be intra-group discourse, i.e. discourse within your group, but it becomes discourse out of your group because you've suddenly created two groups. And there are ways of being able to reunify those groups, to be able to appeal to what we call a superordinate group, the group that sits above both of those subgroups, and to move things along that way. But one of the ways that our siloing works in social media is that social media is very rapid in the algorithms to detect these splits in groups, and does so, you know, by the ways that people like or, you know, use different emoticons or write vitriol and things. And so therefore it reifies and it codifies those two subgroups, which makes appeals to the superordinate group much more difficult. So my doctoral thesis was actually on looking at appeals to the superordinate group of Judaism within the Gospel of John. So you've got these two groups, Judaioi Jews and the Christ-following Jews of the disciples and others who follow after Jesus in the Gospel. How are these two groups appealing to, or how does the Gospel appeal to these, to the superordinate group, to try and reunite these two groups under the Lordship of Jesus? It's supremely difficult to do. I think the Gospel of John fails at doing this. Historically, we can see in the parting of the ways that it fails at doing this. Mm-hmm. And we see over and time and time again throughout history that this sort of group discourse often fails. It fails just as much as it succeeds, if not more than it succeeds. Mm-hmm. One of the uplifting stories is that of in Bulgaria during World War II, politicians successfully appealed to the superordinate group of Bulgarian as superseding, and anyone who's thinking theologically will bristle at this, as superseding the category of Jew. So Bulgarian Jews during World War II were not primarily Jewish. They were primarily Bulgarian. Mm. Their Bulgarian identity superseded their Jewish identity. And because of that, they were categorized as Bulgarian prisoners of war, not Jewish prisoners of war, and so therefore weren't sent to the concentration camps and to the gas chambers. And so, in order to try and appeal to a superordinate group is very risky. to appeal for Romney or for the Republicans for Biden, to appeal to the superordinate group of Republican is very, very risky in terms of their category membership. And it can very easily become an out-group member for the category. And no one wants to become an out-group member of a category because we have so much value and significance attached to that. And especially for a politician who doesn't just have value and significance attached to it, but they have their job and the fact that they can get voted out at the next election attached to that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a really helpful way of thinking about it. And maybe as a kind of final question to kind of make it even more specific is to think about those within evangelicalism who don't sort of fit the voting block, right? So if you watch CNN or Fox News or any of our major media outlets, whenever they talk about evangelicals, right, there's always this idea that they are, you know, quite conservative. And apparently the majority of evangelicals are, right, politically. But that's not true for many evangelicals. And it's always frustrating to be sort of lumped into these larger categories. And for some of us, it makes us wonder if sort of evangelical is like a misnomer, for example, where like the term is not helpful anymore because it only conjures up, you know, certain political trends rather than our sort of historic values as far as conversionism and, you know, evangelism and these sorts of personal transformation and these sorts of things, right? And you almost wonder if like harping on this, it kind of creates a false etymology, right? Where it's like, well, that's what the term used to mean, but it doesn't anymore, yeah. Right? In terms of discourse, in terms of our language, that's not what the term means anymore. Now it means a conservative voting block. And it's like, well, shoot. So now those of us who aren't politically conservative, are we in an out group, right? So maybe as we close, thoughts about that.
Yeah, and I think as an Australian, and John, you'd have experience with this from your time in Scotland, being an evangelical in Australia and being an evangelical in the UK means something very different in terms of political reification.
Totally.
And when people here in Australia use the term evangelical, they often import the American meaning into it in terms of conservatism, in terms of various different political choices, which don't necessarily make sense. So the way that categorization is done, the stereotype that is formed of a Republican right-leaning voter in Australia often is as false as it is true, because we don't actually have the structures behind the category that has been imported. The stereotype doesn't fit, to use a Cinderella analogy, the shoe doesn't fit the princess. Yeah. And yet, people and our media, because of the globalized nature of the media market and the globalized nature of social media, keep wanting to shove the shoe on. Might break a few toes in the process, but you're definitely going to be an evangelical in our mold. This is how you must be.
Yeah.
So that's one of those areas where it just doesn't necessarily fit. And you're right that the more that people appeal to the etymology of it and, you know, dare we say the original intent, can we use the term originalism these days? the more that evangelicals actually appeal to the etymology of it, it actually creates a new group entirely, but confusingly is still named the same as the old group. So there's very little in terms of social group differentiation, because we're still not discussing normativity. We're not discussing what makes a group normative. We're discussing what is comparative with the other big, you know, I've seen big E evangelical, little E evangelical. Little E evangelicals say, we're not big E evangelicals as in the political tribe, because here are all the reasons that we're not that group. And that's a comparative fit metric. We're comparing ourselves with others. Mm-hmm. Whereas we're not, what is under the table and not being talked about is what makes little E evangelicals normative. Mm. And a lot of the time that's not talked about it's not talked about because it's actually shared with the big E evangelicals as well. Mm-hmm. And so if you want differentiation of the groups, you talk about comparative fit. And so this is the struggle, I think, for evangelicals. Can we reclaim a term that actually still makes a lot of sense for the group which it also applies to? Or do you simply go off and make a new group and therefore have a further diversification of groups? I don't know if there is necessarily an answer to that. I think it depends so much on the context and the salience of the context. So like every year I watch on with ETS, the Evangelical Theological Society, and I wonder, like, you know, I'm still an attender of ETS, I'm a member of ETS, but each year I wonder how much of this is discussing comparative metrics. Mm-hmm. How many of the papers are given are majoring on the shibboleths,
yep,
and
yep,
not majoring on the commonalities,
right?
The in-group characteristics, and I think for Christians especially, we need to resist that temptation for constantly talking about others, what makes us different. And rather embrace the challenge of talking about what makes us who we are.
Yeah.
Embrace the challenge of talking normativity rather than comparativity.
Mm.
Because very often the things that we share are far greater than the things that set us apart.
Right.
I think I'm firmly convinced this is what Paul does regularly throughout the epistles. This is what the Gospels do. They talk about the normative things, and they place the comparative things of Jesus with his context, the things that Jesus rightly calls out about his context, mm-hmm, in contrast with the things that he affirms about the context, and affirms about the goodness of humanity, affirms about the goodness of the world, affirms about people's desire to see the Messiah, affirms about people's religious devotion. Mm-hmm. And he, for as many times as he's critiquing people, he is also affirming what is shared and normative, mm-hmm, about things. Mm-hmm. And so we have this discourse which tells us as much about who Jesus was and who he set out to be, what his normative fit is with us, mm-hmm, what we share with him, mm-hmm, as much as it talks about the comparisons, what is different about mm-hmm him, what he sought to confront. And yet we just do a lot of the confronting a lot of the time. And so I think for groups such as ETS, for groups such as our political parties, mm-hmm, we need to be talking a lot more about what makes us who we are. Mm-hmm. So here in Australia, and I know to some degree you seem to have a better system of this in the US, but in Australia, in our last election, we had parties who hadn't even come up with policy statements on most things, mm-hmm, except that their policy was not what the other party was. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we had, parties had policy statements which were not A and not B, mm-hmm, rather than saying X, Y, and Z is what we're going to do.
Right,
we need to major on a discourse which espouses our sense of identity, who we are, rather than denying who we're not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really great. And I think too, even with our division, as just kind of like as we're concluding this conversation, I think with our political division, especially in the States right now, you know, for evangelicals, we can agree on a lot of the principles, and it's the policy differences is really where the division lies. And so we might not agree on what's the best way to get about, you know, implementing this priority and principle and value that we have. And I think, you know, taking a step back and noting those common values and maybe not focusing as much on the kind of policy differences. Obviously, those are huge, they're massive, but I think maybe a way forward is to recognize that, you know, a lot of these kind of differences in policy that evangelicals are advocating for across the aisle, right? We can see those common principles, common values, common priorities that are motivating some of that. We just kind of disagree a bit on how to implement that. Maybe that's kind of a helpful way to find common ground to get back to that normativity of who are we as evangelicals, especially in this divided political climate.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is what Maeve gets at where she talks about things requiring compromise.
Mm-hmm.
In order to get any political engagement done, you need to find what is common, and prioritize what is common between people. Mm-hmm. And you may compromise on some of the details, mm-hmm, but you prioritize what is common and what is normative, mm-hmm, in a shared vision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. Well, this has been a wonderful conversation, Chris. Thanks for being a part of this and sharing a bit more about social identity theory and thinking about how this applies, especially right now as we're gearing up for November 3rd.
yeah, all the best for the election season. It's one of those kind of terrifying but exciting times, and I'm sad not to be in the States to debrief it all over a good craft beer.
Well, we'll do it virtually.
Yeah, indeed.
If you'd like more engagement of theology, culture, and discipleship from the Two Cities, you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, or visit us at our website at thetwocities.com. If you like the content that we put out here on the Two Cities podcast, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts.